Saturday, August 5th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. right here at KPFT Studios, 419 Lovett Boulevard, just southwest of downtown Houston. This is KPFT Houston.
Welcome to another edition of the New Capital Show. I am Leo Gold, your host, 10 o'clock here in Houston, Texas, on, I don't even know what the date is. It's August 3rd. August 3rd. A pleasure to be with you. A pleasure to have you listening. Truly. Our topic today is going to basically follow up on the conversations Amy Goodman was having with the three journalists. We're going to be talking about war, not so much about the media coverage of war. We're going to be talking about war itself, philosophies of it, thoughts about it, feelings about it. I'd like to ask everybody maybe if they could put down their, say, regional or ethnic biases, whatever they are today. I've got my own, and I'll talk about those before we get into the discussion. And let's just talk about war. And specifically, is it ever just? Are there rules of war? What are those rules of war, if there are rules of war? Is there any benefit to war ever? This is an appropriate conversation, in my opinion, to be having with you, with all of you. This, after all, is Pacifica, a station that was founded by a man who resisted World War II. The war that is often thought of as the last good war. And, of course, I'll have some more to say about that particular war and even a little bit on U.S. behavior during that war. But first, we're going to get to a couple of house cleaning items. We'll do a little bit of news. Then we'll talk about war, and we will take your calls here on the New Capital Show. 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. www.newcapitalshow.com is the website. As I talked about, I've done some re-engineering on it, and it looks like it's been successful each week. I will have a headline which will have documents relating to the show and also a place where you can put your comments. And if you want to receive a preview of the show, go to www.newcapitalshow.com and go to the section called Join and fill it out. It's about five lines. Press join, and presto, you will be getting updates before anybody else does on the show. Also, after each show, I get a lot of email from people discussing the show. What I would really like you to do is not just talk to me. I'd like you to talk to each other. And each show, there is a comment section that goes with it. So I love to hear from you. I love it. I truly do. I get the most wonderful emails from listeners. But if you have thoughts about the content of the show, I'd like you to share them with each other as well. I'd like you to share them with each other. That is very important. We form a community of discussion. If you have something you want to say to me personally, that's fine. I'm happy to hear it, and I'm happy to correspond, and I try to answer every single piece of email that I get. I think I do a reasonable job of it. But if you have something that you think that would be fit for public consumption, something that you might otherwise have said by calling in and saying it on the air, put it in the comments section. I'd like to see a week of dialogue about the show. And that's where I'm going to follow up each week with a little bit of mailbag. Last week we talked about Walmart and just a couple of responses to the show on Walmart. Her Soul writes and says, I've been listening for most of the morning, and to be honest, I was a little discouraged about the response from the callers. I am the last person to shop at Walmart, and I feel most of their business dealings are shady at best. While their move toward more green business dealings may be nothing more than a ploy, I think we should not be so quick to judge. We should be critical. It's our job as the public to scrutinize. This does not mean we should all go out and start buying our fish from a supercenter. But the only way to get more businesses to make environmentally responsible moves is to support them when they show interest. Pearl Molly writes in and says, today's show hung up after waiting because a woman made one major point I was waiting to make. It's wonderful if Walmart actually takes a green step, whatever that may be. But until Walmart treats its employees in all countries, not just here, with respect, decent wages, health care, something over 50% of its employees here are on food stamps and Medicaid, and does not represent one of the largest employers of the working poor, I will not shop there. A couple of representative comments on the Walmart show. And again, those actually can be seen on the website. Also, I put a follow-up update on the Walmart show. Lee Scott, the CEO of Walmart, appeared on the Charlie Rose show, and I provided a link to that if you want to see from the person who runs Walmart what his comments are. I did watch that interview, and I guess there was a little bit of substance there that was of interest. Next, we're going to go to a couple of news items. Again, those of you who have gotten the newsletter have already seen these. They're also can be linked to off of the website. So as I bring these up, if you want to bring them up, we can look at them together. First one, in environmental news, Yao Ming swears off shark fin soup. I first became acquainted with shark fin soup a few years ago from a video that was shown, it may have been by Greenpeace, of a fishing vessel that had captured a huge number of sharks in its nets. And I watched as the sharks, is it the dorsal fin? Is that the fearsome fin that you see of a shark? I think it's the dorsal fin. The dorsal fin, you know, the main fin on top of the shark, was cut off. This was being shown on the video. The dorsal fins of the sharks were cut off, leaving a completely disabled shark, and the shark was then thrown back into the water. And of course, the shark had no chance to live. It was one of the cruelest things that I had ever seen. And of course, this has led in recent years to a push to raise awareness about the evil of eating shark fin soup. Well, it looks like Yao Ming, and shark fin soup is eaten, I think, mostly in China, and one of the most prominent of Chinese celebrities has recently announced the following. AP, this is from a couple days ago. NBA star Yao Ming, who actually happens to play here in Houston, pledged Wednesday to give up eating shark's fin soup, a Chinese delicacy, as he joined a campaign to promote wildlife protection. Endangered species are our friends, Yao said at a news conference organized by the London-based conservation group Wild Aid. The group said China is the world's biggest importer of shark's fins, which conservationists say are cut from sharks that are thrown back into the ocean to die. They don't just say it, that is what happens. As the human population increases, many wildlife species are decreasing, and the primary reason is that humans fail to treat animals as friends, said Yao. China alone can save the sharks, said Steve Trent, president of Wild Aid. If sharks are to survive, we need to see a decline in shark fin consumption and new actions by government to control imports and consumption. Hong Kong imported 11,662 tons. Let me give you that number. 11,662 tons of dried shark fin. Can you imagine how many shark fins 11,662 tons represents? Most of which were shipped to mainland China, according to Traffic, a wildlife trade monitoring group. Yao also is to appear in a conservation advertising campaign for wildlife other than sharks. A television commercial shown at Yao's news conference features the 7'5" center jumping up from a basketball court to block a bullet fired from an elephant. You go, Yao. In additional environmental news, casualties of war, Lebanon's trees, air, and sea, July 29th. From Lebanon, as Israel continues the bombing campaign that has turned parts of Lebanon into rubble, environmentalists are warning of widespread and lasting damage. Spilled and burning oil, along with forest fires, toxic waste flows, and growing garbage heaps have gone from nuisances to threats to people and wildlife, they say, marring a country traditionally known for its clean air and scenic greenery. Many of Lebanon's once pristine beaches and much of its coastline have been coated with a thick sludge that threatens marine life. The article goes on to talk about a large oil spill resulting from blowing up oil terminals that now is coating the coastline of Lebanon. Very often, the hidden casualty in war is the environment. Certainly, if we think back to the Vietnam War, war was made not just on the Vietnamese people, but also on the entire Vietnamese countryside, affecting plants, animals, the land itself. A true tragedy, and let's hope it ends soon. We go on now to a bit of Let's see, science news. I'm not sure if it's science news or it's political news. It's both. Evolution opponents lose Kansas board majority. There was a lead-up to this article in the New York Times. This is from the AP. Conservative Republicans who pushed anti-evolution standards back into Kansas schools last year have lost control of the State Board of Education once again. The most closely watched race was in western Kansas, where incumbent conservative Connie Morris lost her Republican primary Tuesday. The former teacher had described evolution as, quote, an age-old fairy tale. I gotta laugh at that. And, quote, a nice bedtime story, unsupported by science. Wow. As I've talked about on this show every single day, if one thing comes out of the world of molecular biology, out of paleontology, out of field biology, if one thing comes out on a daily basis, it is ongoing support and corroboration of the theory of evolution. Every single day, massive quantities of information comes out and is published by scholars, academics, scientists the world over. For someone to say that it is an age-old fairy tale and a nice bedtime story, well, as a result, anyway, she's voted out. As a result of Tuesday's vote, board members and candidates who believe evolution is well supported by evidence will have a 6-4 majority. Evolution skeptics had entered the election with a 2-person majority. Critics of Kansas's science standards worried that if conservatives retained the board's majority, it would lead to attempts in other states to copy the Kansas standards. This is good news. Rational minds prevail, even in Kansas. Next, Republican sponsor Green candidate in Pennsylvania Senate race. There is a fierce race going on in Pennsylvania over the seat held by currently Rick Santorum, Republican. It's worse than we knew, writes a blog that I read, Talking Points Memo. Is the Green Party candidacy in the race for Rick Santorum's seat a wholly Republican-sponsored affair? As reported today by the AP and the Philadelphia Inquirer, the Green Party managed to get their candidate Carl Romanelli on the ballot with a costly petition drive, which was mostly funded by contributors who had also given to Rick Santorum's campaign. The party raised $66,000 for the effort, all of which they spent on a private company to collect signatures. TPM Muckraker was able to establish that at least 55,000, let me say that again, 55,000 of the $66,000 for the Green Party petition effort came from conservative contributors. Virginia Davis, Santorum's spokeswoman, told the Inquirer that their office had encouraged the contributions. Why? Because a challenge from the left is seen as a liability for the Democratic candidate Bob Casey. I'm scheduled to speak to the Green Party of Texas in a few weeks. I'll give you all more information on that. I don't know if it's open to the public. I think it might be. But I will have more to say about politics in this vein at that time. Moving right along. Energy news. Private funds fuel clean energy. Ethanol, solar, and other renewable sources are in venture capital firms' fastest-growing sector. Los Angeles-based alternative energy company Ultra, Inc. raised more than $120 million from private investors in its latest financing round. Let me explain, just for those of you who may not know, how venture capital funds get their money. They are run by a handful of people who are called the general partners. They raise partnership funds. They go to generally wealthy individuals, wealthy families, and to institutional money, which is pension funds generally. They raise the money and then they invest it in a range of companies, startup companies or later stage companies, companies that already have going businesses but need some additional capital to grow their business. So $120 million from private investors is a pretty good size financing that this company Ultra has raised, a sign that major venture capital firms have not been scared off by growing talk that too much money may be chasing too few sustainable ideas in the search to replace gasoline. The new funding, which Ultra could announce as early as today, and this is just a few, August 1st, 2 days ago, brings its total to more than $250 million from some of the nation's top venture capital firms, and it took less than 6 months to line up the cash. Using investments from the likes of Kleiner Perkins, Caulfield and Byers, Sage Capital, and Kosla Ventures, Ultra is building a nationwide network of ethanol and biodiesel plants that will ultimately produce 500 million gallons a year of the fuel. At that level of production, the two-year-old venture would capture a sizable portion of the U.S. ethanol market for vehicles and other uses, which today is about 5 billion gallons. Gasoline usage, by comparison, is 140 to 150 billion gallons a year. A little more news from the world of energy. Vail Resorts goes wind power. Vail Resorts is the company, I think it's publicly traded, which means you can actually buy stock in this company. Vail Resorts owns, of course, Vail, the famous ritzy Colorado resort, but it also owns a handful of other resorts in the area, including Breckenridge, Keystone. Maybe you have gone to these places and skied there. Here's the news. Vail Resorts, the big Colorado ski and recreation company, said Tuesday it would make a huge investment in wind power, buying enough credits to offset all the power needed for its resorts, retail stores, and office buildings. The announcement makes Vail the second largest corporate buyer of wind energy in the nation, according to the EPA, after Whole Foods Markets, the big supermarket chain that went to all wind power earlier this year. Buying wind power, though, will not mean building mountain windmills. Rather, Vail officials said they would buy the equivalent amount of their energy needs in wind power credits from a Boulder company called Renewable Choice Energy. Renewable Choice will then buy wind power from producers, mainly in Minnesota, Kansas, North Dakota, and South Dakota, and inject the amount of power Vail uses into the national electric grid. Does that make sense to everybody? Vail's not putting up windmills. They're buying wind credits. So it's the same thing as you as a consumer purchasing your energy from Green Mountain, right? You're not, when you're using wind power, you're not putting a wind turbine up in your backyard. You're purchasing power that was produced from wind, purchasing a credit, essentially. I, of course, went one further at my ranch. I put up a wind turbine, and I'm still waiting for the wind to blow out there. I'm hurting on that one. Somebody needs to tell me, when does the wind blow in Texas? Is it winter? Winter time? I don't know how long I got to wait. Eric, you know? Eric doesn't know. By the way, Eric, I want to thank you for filling in all these weeks. You're doing a great job. Can I do that? Can I thank you? Yes?
I couldn't hear you. I forgot I had the mic on.
I'm thanking you for helping all these weeks.
Oh, sure. No problem. It's been a lot of fun.
A pleasure to have you. Okay, just a couple more news items, and then we're going to take a short break and get to talk war talk. Let's see. Detroit repeats its sorry history. This is an article on the website. This is talking about how Detroit, yet again, cannot figure out when it needs to put out fuel-efficient cars. Of course, Detroit has now had 30 years, over 30 years, about 35 years since the first oil shock. You think they would have learned in the 1970s. They didn't, and of course, the fortunes of General Motors and Ford are plummeting, at least in terms of their car sales, while those of Japanese car companies that produce more efficient vehicles have been soaring. I think that Toyota the other day announced that they had passed Ford in the United States as the number two producer of automobiles. With $3 gas, Detroit pays for its past. 4 years ago, when Detroit's designers and engineers were working on new vehicles for the middle of the decade, they had only to look out their windows to see what was selling, sport utility vehicles and big pickup trucks. And little wonder, given gasoline prices of $1.36 a gallon on average, it seemed an easy choice for Detroit to stick with these vehicles, which, with their big profit margins, had become its economic underpinning. But in Japan, where engineers and designers were pulling up to gas stations that sometimes charged four times as much for fuel, the answer was to focus on fuel-efficient vehicles. Now those choices are playing out in the automakers' lineups and on their bottom lines. With the United States experiencing its own high gasoline prices, consumers are starting to react like their counterparts elsewhere, choosing fuel-efficient cars as the sale of SUVs and other big vehicles lag. And General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler, which still produce far more of these light trucks than they do automobiles, are now seeing the repercussions, says John Paul McDuffie, a director of the International Motor Vehicle Program, a research group. The cost is not only in lost sales, but more broadly in reputation. The second quarter made that abundantly clear, with gasoline selling for $3 and more across the country. All three Detroit companies reported losses. All three Detroit companies reported losses or sharp declines in their profits in North America. At the same time, consumers' interest in fuel economy was nearly three times as great as it was in 2002, when the decisions about the vehicles Detroit would sell were essentially made. And so it goes. As I've said, you want to change people's behavior real quick, change the price. You'll change their mind real quick by changing the price. One more article on the website. I'm going to let you pick that up yourself if you're interested. It's the story in today's Wall Street Journal of how California has hit speed bumps in trying to kick its own addiction to oil and move to things like ethanol. You know, Wayne Gretzky, the great hockey player, was once asked, what makes you such a great hockey player? And he looked at the questioner and he said, well, I go where the puck is going to be, not where the puck is. And that is basically sums up U.S. energy policy. This country continues to go where the puck is rather than where the puck is going to be. True leadership in this country would have seen a long time ago that energy policy needed to take account of higher gas prices and the true cost of gasoline. We're going to take a real quick break right here. When we come back, we will be opening the phones up and talking about war. This is the New Capital Show. I am Leo Gold, your host. Welcome back to the New Capital Show. I am Leo Gold, your host. We're going to talk about war today. Much in the news, much on many people's minds. War goes on all of the time. It's not just over the past 2 to 3 weeks with the hostilities in Lebanon that war is going on. War is going on across the world in many, many different places. Some receive more coverage than others. War is a scourge. We know that. But is there ever a reason for war to be fought? For defensive purposes, is that a valid fighting of a war to defend yourself? What does defense constitute? My own background is that I am a Jewish American. I grew up in a very tight-knit Houston Jewish community. I saw images of the Holocaust at a very, very young age. I can remember seeing images of bodies being bulldozed into mass graves in concentration camps. I was under 10 years old, and this made a very strong impression on me. I remember crying at a very young age as I saw this happen, and it has stuck with me always. When you see that as at a young age and you realize that the number of Jews in the world is quite small, 16 million I believe the number is, you consider the history the Jews have been through, you take a look and say that Jews must be able to defend themselves as must all people, and even to engage in warfare to do so. Questions that are going on in Israel and Lebanon, the entire Middle East, go far beyond the questions that I see and that I'm raising. I want to invite you all to join the discussion today at 713-526-5738 to talk about war on Pacifica. Pacifica, as far as I can tell, is the greatest media outlet in this country for promoting peace. And to my mind, it is to the great credit of this organization that it stands for peace. And comments at length on war. I had a very influential professor in college, Gordon Levin, and professor of history and political science, and we looked at the U.S. effort in World War II, in particular the U.S. war with Japan, And in particular, my conscience came alive at that time in college regarding the dropping of the atomic bombs on Japan. What I did not know, I had grown up in schools and learned that the dropping of the atomic bombs ended the war and prevented the loss of life of American soldiers. This was what I was told. This was the story. I did not know that in addition to the atomic bombs, the U.S. Air Force had already, by that point, dropped enormous amounts of bombs on other Japanese cities. And in fact, the reason that Nagasaki and Hiroshima were chosen was that they were still left standing where most Japanese cities were not. Many, many civilians had been killed in Japan by that point, by the time that the atomic bombs were dropped in dropping of conventional bombs. Many Japanese cities constructed of wood had burned to the ground, including Tokyo. I also learned that the United States Air Force was, the generals, were very interested in dropping the atomic bomb on Kyoto, which is a place that I have been. It is a staggeringly beautiful city. It is the embodiment of peace and tranquility and representative of one of the great world religions. And it was only through the efforts of Secretary of War, ironically, Henry Stimson, whose wife was familiar with the importance of Kyoto and impressed upon the Secretary of War that Kyoto should not be bombed. Henry Stimson, the Secretary of War of the United States, had to take off the list Kyoto several times before the generals finally stopped putting it on. My political science class brought to me the point that making war on civilians crosses a line in the waging of war, and that it should not be done, and it is the number one rule of war in my book. Making war on civilians is against any rule of making war. To make war on civilians removes any constraint that there would be. As a father now of a young child, I am very saddened and very grief-stricken to see images of children being killed in war. My heart goes out to all of the parents and all of the families who are losing children. I cannot possibly imagine. As I say, if you are making war, you must face a choice. You must either decide not to harm civilians, or you must change your demands and your goals in making war. In the case of the atomic bomb, the United States was demanding the unconditional surrender of Japan. If the United States in World War II was not able to get the unconditional surrender of Japan through conventional means, meaning making war against other soldiers rather than against civilians, then the United States needed to change its conditions. 713-526-5738. We're going to go to the phones now, and our first call of the day is Herman. Herman, welcome.
Good morning. I have a lot to say, and I hope I don't forget any of it, but I have two uncles in the Second World War. Both served in the Pacific. One was in the Coast Guard, one was in the Navy. The Japanese sunk the ship, the Coast Guard ship. My uncle had to swim in the ocean from one vessel to another. The uncle who was in the Navy ship was bombed by the Japanese as well. They both survived the war. I have served in Europe in the United States Army, and I lived, after I got out of the Army, I stayed in Europe and went to school there for a while. I lived in a town called Arolsen, and there were ovens in Arolsen. I never met a German who knew anything about the ovens in the city where I lived. I never met a German who fought on the Western Front. Now, be that as it may, if you were impressed by the pictures you saw of the Holocaust and other people, there was a bunch of black army units were some of the first to reach the concentration camps to free the Jews. And I've talked to some of those people who were in those units years ago. Now, the generals in Israel have seen those pictures. And who can blame them if they say, Ish Eiramish of Kristallnacht and Genug is Genug?
Mm-hmm.
I remember Kristallnacht and enough is enough.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Now, that's the mindset of these people. Now, William Paley was famous for an analogy. Mine won't be profound, but if you have an enclosed area with a fence around it, and alligators or lions or whatever is in that enclosure, and there's a sign on that enclosure that says IDF. And somebody scales that fence, goes into that enclosure, and the alligators or the lions or whatever start devouring him. Others are going to look before they leap in there to save that person. Now, the Lebanese have some blame for allowing Hezbollah to become as important as they were in Lebanon. And if you're going to be next door to a country that has everything, F-15s, tanks, you name it, Israel has it, then you're going to need something similar to that. And if you allow some idiot to upset the apple cart, just provide the stimulus for this response that Israel has given them, then you deserve some of the blame for causing this.
Harmon?
Yes.
Thank you for the comments.
All right.
713-526-5738, New Capital Show. We are talking about war. What is war? Is it just? Is it ever just? Are there rules of war? Next call is our friend Abadi. You're on, my friend.
How you doing, Leo?
Good.
I'd like to say we're going much... We need to go back. We need to... First of all, there's nothing new going on in East Africa than the undoing of what T.E. Lawrence put together. Lawrence of Arabia is the man responsible for the creation of most of the so-called Arab nations, and it was against the will of the interest of Britain, France at the time, and they are undoing what Lawrence did. Anyone that wants to understand what's going on, all they need to do is check out the movie Lawrence of Arabia, and a moron could follow what's going on. But I think the question is a much larger one, and I don't want to trivialize, but I also don't want to have us lose sight of the bigger question. The bigger question is war. What is the motive and the interest of war? The motive and the interest of war is to acquire something that you don't have a natural right to.
Mm-hmm.
That's the basic bottom line. And nations, fortunes, and individual and family fortunes are greatly affected by being able to acquire resources that they don't have natural rights to. So when Edwin Starr, every time I hear Edwin Starr being played on Amy Goodman, war, what is it good for? That is the most idiotic notion in the world. It is good for many, many, many things. If you are an industrialist, if you are a financier, if you are a energy producer, if you are a coffins manufacturer, you know, what is it good for? It's a multi-trillion dollar industry. So we're not going to see a cessation of war until a couple of things happen. Everybody has atomic capabilities and delivery systems, and then war becomes ridiculous and no one's going to do it. But as long as there are people who have military economic power, who have designs on people's resources and lands, et cetera, and they want disproportional and unfair access to those, they will use war. So I don't think we can talk about the issue of war in a vacuum without looking at the motive.
Let me ask you this, Abadi.
Yes.
You're rightly drawing our attention to the economic issues involved in war. That it's good.
Well, more than economics.
Okay.
Leo.
Well, hang. I know. I know. There's
social,
more. But, right. But I want to focus on that one aspect. I know. But let me focus on that one aspect because
okay.
I can't do them all at once. The question gets too broad then. But focusing on the economic aspects, it's good business. How do you see war's net benefit or loss on the balance sheet, which is to say dollars that are being invested in going to war could have been invested somewhere else, let's say into rejuvenating toxic dumps in the U.S. or in putting into transport, investing in transportation. War crowds out. The dollars put to war crowds out investment into other areas.
Well, in an ideal
what does the net look like to you? When you look at it, what is the net? How does it net out? Does war earn a net return?
Yes, definitely a net return. Because prior to the outward expansion of Europe through war, under the guise of the search for the silver chalice and right. and all that other bullshit.
You're going to get the FCC on me.
The circumstances of Europe and European society was very dismal. And it was war and wars that brought Europe out of the Dark Ages and brought Europe out of being the economic anus of the world, et cetera, to its place of prominence. So war has been very, very good for Europeans and European society. Mm-hmm. And in fact, you can directly graph, you're the economist, and you can directly graph the ascent of fortunes and well-being, etc., with every European nation on the planet. Well, they're only located in one geographical location, but every European nation's progress economically, politically, etc., are directly proportional to wars and directly proportional to their use of military might to have colonies. France, and the reason why Haiti is such a horrible, horrible story of ongoing assault against a people who dared to wish to be free, that the fortunes of France was directly proportional to their domination and exploitation of Haiti. So when we look at what is happening in the world and what has been happening for over 2,006 years and 7 months, we have to understand the total relationship, absolute indisputable relationship between the power base of Western societies and governments and systems in their domination of third world lands, resources, and people. And as the famous British general, and I don't remember what his name is, says, when they were discussing limitations on warfare and establishing rules, first of all, you have to understand the rules of war for white people. And he said, we've got to reserve the right to bomb the niggers. Mm. Okay? So warfare, and there's always been atrocities committed by colonial armies against defenseless people.
Abadi, I have just learned about a book called Imperial Reckoning, The Untold Story of Britain's Gulag in Kenya. Are you familiar with this book?
No, I'm not. I'm very familiar with what European nations have done in Africa.
Let me move along here. I'm going to announce to everybody this book. I've just learned about it. Thanks for the call.
Very good.
This is a book called Imperial Reckoning, The Untold Story of Britain's Gulag in Kenya. This highlights the years 1952 to 1960 as Britain went through the throes of decolonization. This book is by Caroline Elkins, who is a Harvard professor. It won the Pulitzer Prize this year, won the highest honor that this country can bestow upon works of history, the Pulitzer Prize. Highly recommended. And I think that you can see, I didn't catch it, but I think she was on Charlie Rose last night talking about this book. I think that the book holds cautionary tales for the United States and its involvement in Iraq. Thanks to Abadi for an always provocative discussion. And our next call of the day is Alan. Alan, welcome.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I don't think idealistically that war is ever justified except in the case of self-defense. That being, war in the case of imperialism, colonization, or just plain old conquering, like Abadi said, for goods and goods that you don't have, whether it's or riches that you don't have, land, gold, that's not justified. And yet war is so embedded in the woof and weave of human history. If you remove the thread, human history would fall apart. It's just a part of our existence and nature, and I don't believe for one minute that the optimistic views or Pollyannic views that war will ever end and we will bring peace to earth. It's just not going to happen. I think that we will destroy ourselves ultimately.
Alan, thank you. 713-526-5738. This is the New Capital Show. We're talking about war. Well, let's just keep going here. Stephen, you're next.
Oh, yes. How are you doing today?
Good.
Good deal. I've just heard one of the best articulations of a point of thought from Abati that I think I've ever heard. And, I think it was very eloquent in the manner he laid that out. But I think more central to the question that you were asking earlier with relationship to the actual lives that are being lives and who lives these are and what type of lives these are, I think it's an absolute point of hypocrisy that we so casually paint broad strokes across the evaluation of these people's lives.
Yeah, can you imagine being ripped out of your home and sent packing and to where?
Not even just from that standpoint. It is hard for me to understand that if we had that same governmental system operating outwardly and doing it, I think it's already, when you have the introduction of crack into a neighborhood or this and that, crime rates in different parts, the whole New Orleans, all this type of madness, it's done, but it's done more surreptitiously, I think, upon American culture. But you have cultures out there, societies out there where it's just so blatant, and then you're asked to somehow tuck this into another set of realities that make it acceptable actions, and that stirs up a whole another set of madness. And no wonder you have the type of criminal and atrocities being visited upon this country and throughout our society every day. The whole madness of the sniper on the freeway there. Clearly, this is a guy who loves to kill, so he should be in some type of scenario where that theater of madness is, his reality, and soon those type of mentalities would die if they only played with each other. But it's when it's visited upon the everyday citizen, the common Joe, that you have these things that should be deemed as crimes against humanity and prosecuted as such.
Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you.
Next call of the day, we're talking about war, is Mark. Mark, welcome.
Hi, great show, Leo. I always enjoy listening.
Thank you.
I hope the one caller is wrong, that we're on the path to destruction.
You know, Mark, there is a Buddhist vow. The Buddhist vow is, and Abadi stirred my thoughts of this Buddhist vow. The Buddhist vow is, a Buddhist does not take what is not given. A Buddhist does not take from another what is not given. which, when you juxtapose, I think Abadi makes absolutely correct points, that so much of war is based upon the co-opting, taking. Of resources.
Absolutely.
The resources of others, and what does it take? It takes a change in the human mind to a mindset of a human does not take what is not given, and the irony is that in that world much is given. and that's a Christian perspective, I think, as well. I have hope
that's been lost.
Well, I don't know, I can't tell. Anyway, you had comments, please.
Well, two things. I know we're mostly talking about weaponized war, but just the harm we do to others. There's psychological war, gulags, the separation of people that are fully dependent on others for their water, their fuel, their jobs, you name it, their schools. Like you said, I think for a long, long time, man has just struggled with reaching a true democracy, a true egalitarian society. Yeah, most of that net profit that Abadi was talking about for the European nations, what we have to remember is those European nations, mostly at that time, were kingships. The common people didn't have a lot of input into the government. Governments aren't always for and by the people. A lot of times government is just the ruling elite, whether it's a kingship or what have you, plutocracy or what have you. So if we can get past harming one another, either through weapons or psychological warfare, if we could just learn to sit down at the table. And this is what really disturbs me about a lot of conflicts is we feel like we're better off prolonging conflicts, and that just leads to a scorched earth type scenario. In other words, the war is just, it, we can't find an end to it because we just allow it to continue. Like you said, there was no purpose to drop the atomic bombs, but we do it anyway. And that whole mentality, like you said, has got to change. Every religion, like you said, has a piece of spirituality that reaches out to others. And whatever religion you are, you need to hang on to that instead of saying, well, you need to back because you're a Muslim and, you know, Hezbollah says this part needs to be pushed to the extreme. And you have Christian churches in this country saying the same thing. Well, you know, this country stands for Christ, and we need to just follow this cross wherever it leads us. Well, hey, I don't think Jesus would be too happy hearing that we're carrying on warfare in his name. I don't think that is what he represents.
Thank you, Mark.
Thanks, Leo.
Next up is Gary. Gary, welcome to New Capital Show.
Hey, Leo. Leo, I just wanted to ask for a little bit more of the analysis on the economic cost-benefit analysis of warfare. I heard callers giving opinions, but I don't really hear a lot of analysis. Now, certainly it enriches the individuals that are pulling the strings, the military-industrial complex, etc. It enriches them. It certainly can rally a population to high productivity, and high productivity can be good for an economy. But then on the other hand, you've got the devastation that occurs with war when, you know, a country is, you know, devastated and blown to pieces. And then, as you say, well, you know, we could invest our dollars and our motivation in other directions. And, you know, surely war motivates people and can increase productivity. And possibly on that side of the equation, people could say, well, it's good for the economy. But on the other hand, couldn't we motivate people towards something different and use something other than war to motivate people and have all of the good effects of the high productivity without the effects of the devastation? I'd like to hear your economic analysis on
Well, Gary, I very much appreciate this call, and I have never seen or read any kind of overall analysis of the economy of war. I'd like to find something. If anyone knows of a good book on that, that's fine. What Abadi is indicating, and I think it's right to some extent, is that, you know, when wars have been fought in the past, sometimes wars are big economic winners for those who win. And it may be that wars that you win are have a net benefit. And when I say net benefit, I mean the benefits less the costs. If the costs are higher than the benefits, then clearly there's not going to be a net benefit. There's going to be a net negative. So when we look at
all parties,
yes, exactly right. It so much depends upon what your perspective is. You have to look in a global world, frankly, in a moral world, you have to take a look what is the net effect on all parties, all humans, to see is there any net benefit. And too often we take a look at what is the net benefit to one particular party, the victor in the war. So I'd like to see some kind of rigorous economic analysis that does exactly what you're saying, which is take all the parties to a war and what is the net to the planet? What is the net to what's the net to the planet?
Yeah.
I can't imagine it's positive. It's got to be negative.
Sure. And like
I could be wrong.
Yeah, and it seems you do have productivity increases when an entire country rallies behind one cause and is highly motivated by fear and other factors, you know, motivational factors.
But what is it that you're developing? What are you developing? You're developing, you know, it's going into weapons and battleships and these things, not going into public transportation systems and scrubbers to clean coal plants and sequestration systems to put, you know, to reuse CO2 and so on.
Right. And I'm just saying that motivation, even like you're talking about, where are you putting the development, but also other ways to motivate people towards, you know, you can use other than the fear of war and the horrible enemy. You know, true leaders can take a country in a positive direction, very productive places. It happens occasionally. Mm-hmm. It's not enough in the world, but it can happen, and we can get all of the benefits of highly motivated people and high productivity without the destructive aspects of war if only we had different leadership. But then that kind of begs the question of, well, who puts the leadership in place? But I'm just putting it out there for discussion.
Gary, thanks for the call.
Thanks.
Next up is Martin. Martin, welcome to the New Capital Show.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Mm-hmm. I appreciate your show, brother.
Pleasure to have you.
I'll try and pack as much as I can into as few words as I can.
Yeah, let's go quick. We got a bunch of calls in 10 minutes.
As a referral for your previous caller, you might check out Main Currents in Modern American History by Gabriel Kolko. It does make the economic war connection.
Give the name again.
It's called Main Currents in Modern American History by Gabriel Kolko.
Yeah, I've heard of him, the historian Kolko.
Yeah, he's from Canada, uh-huh. So you can look at us objectively. In any event, I think we have to be a little Socratic and intellectually honest about what we're doing here. The war is just a business. That's all it is. At the height of the Cold War in this country, we had like 30,000 nuclear weapons. There is no strategic need for that. It's a matter of the people who make these weapons are driving procurement. So they make a lot of money by dictating our policy. We are not getting out of the war business. And if we're going to be intellectually honest, I would refer people back to Madame Albright's comments to Leslie Stahl. Leslie Stahl told her that our embargo of Iraq had cost the lives of 500,000 children, and she thought that was a high price. Was it worth it? Madame Albright, in a rare moment of honesty, said, well, it's a tough call, but we think it's worth it. That's a genocidal policy.
Mm-hmm.
When we don't rein our leaders in when they're telling us that they're outrightly that they're conducting genocidal policies, we are responsible for the government we have, and we're responsible to the rest of the world. And we can't start history on 9/11 or whatever time is convenient for us. We have to adjust our policies today. And since World War II, over half of all the casualties in war had been non-combatants. That means when we go to war, we know more than half the people we kill are going to be innocent.
Breaking my number one rule, which is you don't make war on civilians.
Well, but that's been the case since World War II.
Yes, it has.
War is terrorism.
Yeah.
Bottom line. Thank you, brother.
Martin,
appreciate
you
having me on.
Thanks for the call, Martin. We've got another, I don't know, 7 minutes or so. Next up is Steve. Steve, welcome to New Capital Show.
Hey, Leo, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. Yeah, I wrote a song actually called Mrs. Simpson Says No about what you were talking about earlier about Japan.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I was going to say that war to me has been pretty much following technology. It's like the style of war basically follows like bigger and bigger bombs, airplanes, nuclear weapons, and whatnot. And it seems like as technology has accelerated in the last 25 years, 30 years with computers and stuff, we're really seeing the acceleration of war technology. And it seems to me that every single little war has almost been a military experiment as much as any other purpose.
I mean, Steve, look what's going on right now in Lebanon. You have Israel, which has the latest airplane technology, and you know, they're firing missiles and dropping bombs, and that's killing civilians. They're saying it's an effort to get Hezbollah, and it probably is. I wouldn't think you drop expensive bombs on civilians. I don't think they're doing it on purpose, and they've apologized. But there's a technological use of this airplane, And yet it's just trying it out, and it's not working. Apparently it's not having any effect. And the same for Hezbollah on the other side, launching rockets indiscriminately into Israel. I think Hezbollah doesn't want to kill Israeli civilians. It wants to, you know, terrorize the country. But there it is. You have this increasing technology, and it doesn't seem to be very effective.
Well, you see, they're not only experimenting, though, with a technology, they're experimenting with a strategy. I think the strategy here is getting another country to fight your war for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's...
And do it.
Yeah.
But as far as what they're doing, as far as the dropping the bombs, it's like that game in the carnival where the little gophers pop their heads out of the holes and you try to hit them with a mallet, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like, it's logically impossible for them to actually, you know, hit those rocket launchers because they're mobile.
Right.
They hit where they only are hitting the spot that they were, you know, hours or days before.
Steve, thanks for the call.
They know it doesn't work.
Yep. Thank you. A few minutes left. Laurent, I think. Is it Laurent?
Hey there.
Welcome.
How you doing? Okay. I noticed the comment you just made, and maybe because that, you know, you are Jewish, but most Jewish people I talk to do believe that Israel accidentally bombed the outpost.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The thing is, I don't think that. The reason being that I feel it is on purpose. There's been a lot of, not a lot, but there's been a few people from former German intelligence, former French intelligence, who's been talking about these microwave weapons that's being used over there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is an interesting point. Who makes those weapons? The number three largest manufacturer, which is GE, who owns NBC, and the number five manufacturer of weapons, which is the Carlyle Corporation, where former President George Bush sits on the board of directors and where President George Bush was working for before he became governor of Texas. They make these weapons. These weapons are being used, and these weapons are being sold. This is a selling ground, just like Vietnam was a selling ground for the M-16, for the F-15, F-18, F-16.
Okay, Laurent, so you're echoing Abadi's comments, this war's good business.
It's business.
Yep.
This is what this is. This is a selling ground. And you find that corporate-controlled media does not want to talk about this.
Mm-hmm.
Those people, those former German intelligence people, former French intelligence, is talking to people overseas. They're talking to them, but they will not get on camera. They will not let them get on the airways here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Laurent, thank you. Common theme we're hearing today from our listeners, this is a business. And I guess that's appropriate for the New Capital Show. One more call of the day is going to be Gabriel. Gabriel.
Yes, I so agree with you about business and war. I mean, the Krupp's company is well noted for selling arms to both sides of conflicts from the late 1800s.
Mm-hmm.
But what I want to give to you is a completely new perspective.
Real quick, Gabriel, we've only got a...
On World War II.
Great, we've got a minute left.
Okay, it's completely different. I was kind of inspired by Mel Gibson, but there was this young man in Vienna a long time ago that wanted... He was making his living painting postcards for the tourists, and he wanted to go to art school, okay? And he wanted to go to that art school, but they rejected him. Now, I don't know if that had anything to do with Jews, but this particular individual perceived it that way, and it's well documented in his book, Mein Kampf.
Gabriel, thank you. Those of you interested in the origins of Hitler, I finished a book recently called Explaining Hitler by Ron Rosenbaum, a truly fascinating, fascinating read. That does it for today's show on war. There's a lot more that can be said, and I hope that you will say it at www.newcapitalshow.com in the comments section on today's show. I hope that you will all take the time to speak not just to me but to each other, and let's continue the discussion. Joe, Kanan, and Don, I'm sorry we ran out of time today. We will be back next week with you for another edition of the New Capital Show. Quick on the trigger there, Eric. I hope all of you have a great week. Great weekend. Take care.
Calling all bike riders and volunteers to fight breast cancer. The Dasani Tour de Pink 2006 is fast approaching. On September 10, Pink Ribbons Project hosts its second annual fundraising bike ride, sponsored by Dasani and other generous supporters. Riders raise money for Pink Ribbons Project, Dancers in Motion Against Breast Cancer. Contributions and pledges will help fight breast cancer through awareness and education, free screenings, and research initiatives. Last year's ride was a huge success. Over 1,000 riders registered. This year's event has routes from 12 to 100 miles. The starting line is at Prairie View A&M near Hempstead. So dust off your helmets, tune up your bikes, and join us on Sunday, September 10 at 7:30 a.m. on the start line. To register or to volunteer, visit tourdepink.org on the web. That's TOURDEPINK.